This podcast is an initiative of the Australian Intercollegiate Meat Judging Association to showcase the career paths within the meat processing industry. ICMJ is a not-for-profit association which aims to provide opportunities for students to learn, building the pool of intelligent young meat industry representatives into the future. ICMJ does this through a series of events across Australia and overseas. For more information, head to the website icmj.com.au. Australian Jess Pryles has gone from city living in Melbourne to Austin, Texas, where she's known to many as the hardcore carnivore, a hunting, meat-smoking, low-and-slow barbecue expert with an Aussie accent. I'm Amy McCosker, and I started my conversation with Jess by asking how she found herself on the other side of the world studying meat science and cooking barbecue.
I remember so clearly, like, mum making, like, broiled lamb cutlets and how good that would taste. And she wasn't the best meat cook and still isn't. So I loved eating it, but I didn't really know much about cooking it, and it wasn't sort of passed on in my family. So, like, I didn't really buy steak at home because, you know, you'd heard too many conflicting things like, oh, 7 minutes on each side. Oh, I don't know. It's all a bit complicated, and barbecues are really, you know, terribly dirty and they just take too much effort. So, like, I'd buy a porterhouse steak every now and again in the grocery store and just cut the fat off in one go, which I would never do these days, ever. But that was sort of as close as I got. Otherwise, I just waited until I was out of a restaurant to order. And then a trip to Texas probably 12 or 13 years ago now changed all of that. And when you come to Texas, especially Central Texas and Austin where I am, you have to go on a barbecue crawl. It's what you do. There's a town about 45 minutes out that's literally known as the barbecue capital of Texas. And I remember the first time I had smoked beef ribs. And even though barbecue is hugely popular in Australia now, at the time we didn't have anything like it. And I just so clearly remembered the first time I had that meal and how delicious it was. And I was like, oh my God, it's everything I love about, you know, the crusty bit on the top of a lamb chop, but it's the whole thing. It's the whole thing. And, you know, it was handy that I was in Texas and it's very beef centric, of course. So I fell in love with Texas, fell in love with barbecue, and I kept coming back kind of year after year. And I got more fascinated in how barbecue was cooked and then realized I had no idea, you know, what is a brisket? If I go back to Australia and ask for a brisket, like, why does this look nothing like the ones in America? I mean, I knew nothing about it. And that just led me down this rabbit hole of cattle breeds and how old they are and why it's different and butchery cuts being different in different parts of the world and why are the cattle bigger in the US and, like, just this head exploding of, like, uncovering all of this new information that I just had not been privy to. And as I started to learn, you know, I would get more in touch with ag people, I guess, try and find industry people, and I ended up just teaching myself and learning from people as much as I could. So doing a slaughterhouse tour, and which was pretty extraordinary, but it kind of goes to show you how open the industry was. And just also teaching myself how to cook. I was like, well, that's it. I'm going out and I'm buying a charcoal grill because I'm just going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it the hardest way. I'm going to buy an offset wood-fired smoker and I'm just going to figure it out. And luckily, I was pretty good at figuring it out. So I've kind of developed into, you know, a recipe developer. And as I was learning things, I would share them. I had a blog at the time because I really enjoyed writing. And I would share, like, information that I learned about meat or how to cook it. And obviously, that resonates with people because a lot of other people are looking for the same information. And eventually, it led to, you know, well, people can taste the food that I want to taste through my recipes, but how else do I get them to know how I think things should taste without starting a restaurant? And so I brought out my first seasoning, which was Hardcore Carnivore Black. And now, 4 years later, we have 5 seasonings in the line. We have branded butcher paper, gloves, brisket slicing knives. Like, it's a whole hardcore carnivore empire. And then eventually, you know, I kept kept meeting people in the industry, kept learning things. And then I just got to the stage where I ended up enrolling at Iowa State University, and I'm currently completing a graduate certificate in meat science, which, considering I did no science in high school, is hilarious to me and my mother. So I had to apply for special permission to kind of use life experience as the basis for qualifying for that course. And I guess I kind of did it backwards, because most people go to college or go to university and then start a career. But because I do have a really, you know, respectable following on social media, it's also been really important to me to make sure that I'm educating people correctly and sharing correct information. So meat science and understanding that side of the industry has always been so fascinating to me. And I like making sure that I'm not, you know, I've heard other people, other influencers, I guess, for example, tell people that the purge inside Vacuum Seal is an injected solution, you know, and I think the more people that are out there crushing meat myths, the better.
Are you being a bit modest there? Because when you say you've got a respectable social media following, you've actually got 134,000 followers on Instagram alone. So it's pretty impressive. Could you tell us a bit more about what role that social media presence has played in your career?
Really significant for me, because before, to be a voice amongst a herd, pardon the pun, you really had to kind of have really good luck. You had to sort of end up on TV, or you had to end up, you know, it was a really very small fraction of people sort of back in the day that could make their voices heard and be influenced. And the invention of social media and platforms where everyday people can decide who they are interested in following rather than being dictated by a network has made a tremendous difference. Because the reason it all started, as I sort of kind of started on this journey, I always enjoyed writing. So I started a blog way back when, and it was to just share what I'd learned. It started by just sharing like the meals that I was having when I would visit Texas and Austin. And then it started, you know, then I would expand that to, well, here's a recipe that I've developed, or here's something I learned. And now it goes all the way to, you know, dry aging and kind of complicated meat stuff. But that ability to share and people deciding that they were interested in it has been everything, because that built my audience. So it's been really awesome to be able to connect with people that way.
Social media can be, I think, quite daunting for some people as well, particularly when it's something that can be quite divisive, such as, you know, the meat eating movement versus the vegan movement. We see both of those sides of the fence being really active on social media. And I think when you put yourself out there, you know, there's a risk that you're going to rub up people that disagree with you. How do you sort of get around, you know, to use a phrase that's used in this space a bit, how do you get around the haters?
So it's funny you say that, because I guess for context, like, it's easy for us to say, well, you know, vegans are always going to attack you. And I had one yesterday, and I haven't had one in such a long time. But I posted, like, I've learned to hunt since I moved to Texas, and it's not like going and killing a lion for trophy hunting. It's like the same as roo hunting or deer hunting in Australia, where you now have an invasive, sometimes native, but sometimes invasive population that needs culling and has a season, and you hunt it and you use the meat. And I posted a picture of a deer that I killed last week and lost a ton of followers, and even had someone who had spent the last year sending me, you know, kind of fanboy messages say, oh, too far, keep your guns and your hunting to yourself. And it's like, where do you think meat comes from? So sometimes people's comfort zones, you know, you can't be responsible for them. You can only follow what you feel is true and right for you when you're posting on social media. Probably about, I want to say, 5 years ago, I had a big, big attack from some vegans on my account. And it was at the time, like, I had been to slaughterhouses in Australia, and I had just gone to the slaughterhouse, or I guess it's the meat lab at Texas A&M University. And I'd posted, I think it was just like a photo of my boots on the floor with some blood splatter next to them, with a kind of like mindful caption about, you know, I toured this slaughterhouse and this is where your meat comes from. Or it might have even been, I think I might have even posted a carcass at the time and just people couldn't handle it. Because I don't mind posting that stuff. I don't have an employer that's going to tell me not to do it. You know, it's real and it's what it looks like and that's how it's processed. So what happened was that that particular image got picked up by a vegan group, and they kind of are, I guess, well organized. So they shared it with each other really quickly, and someone shared it to their page and did a big shout out telling them to come attack my page. And I pretty much had to sit there for like 5 hours and just block, 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 because there was some really hateful speech in there. That was sort of the worst part. But really, aside from that, and aside from the occasional, you know, militant post, it's just not a problem. People tend to stick in their crowd. So I generally attract like-minded people.
As a platform, social media is helping more than hindering. Obviously, it's helping you get, you know, like you said, the reality of where people's meat and where people's food comes from, you know, right in front of people. And you see that as a valuable thing?
I think it's a tremendously valuable thing for a variety of reasons. I think that it's offered transparency to consumers that want to learn more about it. But I also think from like an industry perspective, it's given us a really interesting educational component that didn't exist before. So there are so many meat enthusiasts on, let's say, Instagram right now. If you ask someone what a bavette or a flapsteak was 3 years ago, they might have looked at you funny. But now we're seeing, I think, a rise in secondary cuts and overall meat knowledge, where the industry and the butchers' shops don't have to work as hard to educate people to move secondary cuts or move other pieces, because they're sort of learning about them themselves. And again, it's that result of not only drinking from one hose. So instead of just being exposed to whatever the grocery store wants to give you, you're now being exposed to so much more information that it, I think it really does help.
Jess, obviously I can tell you from this end in Australia, there's a huge amount of interest in that American style of barbecue. And I think that that's, part of what's really attracted people to your social media and to your rubs and your website, because over here, we're just loving that American style and trying to create that over here. We can't sort of get it in very many restaurants. But I was wondering what it's like to on the other side for you, being an Australian person in Texas. What's sort of the perception over there of our style of barbecue and our style of meat eating? And, you know, I can hear a Texan twang in your voice as you speak. And, you know, I think you've been there for a while now. So, but I'm sure they still pick up the Aussie in your voice as well. So what's that like on your end?
So it's quite interesting. I helped found the Australasian Barbecue Alliance, which was sort of the first formal body acknowledging barbecue was getting big in Australia. And it now is the largest competition sanctioning body in the Southern Hemisphere, which is pretty neat. And unfortunately, the general go-to over here when they think about Australians barbecuing is shrimp on the barbie. But it's like a thing. It's like everyone knows about it and everyone just sees Australia like that or relates it. And I don't think that they realize, like, to me, Australian barbecuing growing up was a flat top grill and sausages, like cheap sausages. I don't even think, I think that even the way Australians grill, like use a grill and the difference being that barbecue is generally like low and slow cooking. But I feel like that's come so far, because when I moved to Texas, like the people who grilled, the guys who grilled in their backyard were really quite gourmet. They wrapped bacon around things and they got sauces together and they brushed sweet relishes over things. Whereas I think like historically you'd go out and like cremate some porterhouses, you know, like I don't think we had this great history of being very proficient fire cooks in Australia, you know, but what's happened is Now, also, I think interestingly, like when Americans think about Australian meat, I'm seeing a lot of people post about Australian Wagyu because a lot of the Wagyu companies down there have started doing marketing pushes over here. And it's funny because, as you know, that doesn't mean anything. It just means it's Wagyu beef from Australia. Like, is it crossbred? Is it F1? Like, is it who made it? Who fed it? How many days was it on grain? Like, all the information that we know matters doesn't matter. They're just proud to be posting that they're eating Australian Wagyu. So that's become quite a thing as well, which is interesting.
That is really interesting, and I know that there's a lot of focus in the Australian industry on this clean green push, and that's something that's discussed a lot within the industry internally. Is that sort of appearing on the other end as well? Is that something that consumers overseas are actually latching onto?
It is. There's a lot of direct to consumer box services, like butchery boxes that have started, which actually is a really interesting kind of pain point for me because there are people who want to eat. I mean, obviously, saying clean and green, it depends. You know, are we talking about just sustainable farming? Are we talking about what that does? Are we talking about the beef itself? But there's a lot of consumers here that look for grass-fed. There's nearly no one understands that generally American grass-fed beef is going to be seriously inferior in eating quality, just because of the lack of marbling and size compared to the grain-fed that they're used to eating here. Like Australian grass-fed is miles above what an American grass-fed steak would be, just again in terms of eating quality, nothing else. And so they're looking for that. And then what's happened is because everyone's sort of trying to make a living, I'm seeing a lot of stuff where the industry is cannibalizing itself. And that's what I have a real problem with. So I have a problem, like there's enough of a problem facing from things like impossible meat and non-meat meat that's coming and attacking the industry. That seeing companies attack each other by using marketing phrases like healthier beef, better beef, safer beef, like that's what a lot of these box services are doing. They're preying on people's fears who don't actually understand the nutrition or anything else behind. They just assume that big beef means that it's got to be bad for you or someone's taking advantage of them or something like that. And so they're saying, well, this is healthier and cleaner and safer. Well, why is it safer? Arguably, it's not safer because it's not under a strict, it's not been processed in a plant that's got as many people looking at it as a tiny little, home kill or farm kill or whatever. So I don't, it, the movement is definitely there, in terms of grass-fed beef becoming popular as a health thing. But let me assure you, I don't think it's as strong as it is in Australia because at the end of the day, it's like ingrained in American culture that you need like a 16-ounce big ass bone-in ribeye, and it should be
Should be
fatty and
fatty
it
in it.
should be delicious. I guess what I'm saying is, whereas there's a sort of general movement in Australia, even if that was a small movement here, which it is, like it's a big movement, but we're talking 30 versus 300 million people. Even if you have a huge swell of people that are into sort of health eating and clean eating and only seeking out grass-fed product, you've still got just as many people that are like, I don't care, you can keep your grass-fed to yourself. I want a big fatty steak. And I think that that's what you're seeing less of in Australia.
So, how would you say? I mean, this probably harks back a bit to your communications background and your sort of past life as well as what you do now. But how would you say? What would your advice be, I suppose, to people on differentiating their product without, to use your term, sort of cannibalizing others? So, without saying, we're the best because the others are no good. What? How do you be positive, I suppose, about what you offer without being negative about what others are trying to sell?
Well, I think it's just about, I think for me, it comes down to not fear mongering. So it's really the phrases more, healthier and cleaner. And as anyone who's listening to this podcast, who's even mildly involved in the industry knows, like, it's very, very vague to say my beef is healthier than yours, because it depends on so many factors and what you consider to be healthy, right? I think that a positive thing would be just focusing on the positives in of what your meat offers. And the other thing, sorry, I'm getting a bit tangenting, but the other thing that I wonder if it'll do more damage eventually is that a lot of these small holders are now trying to go direct to public just because the way of the industry being cattle calf and then going direct to consumer means that they're not making as much as if they can get it all the way, vertically integrated direct to consumer at the end. But there's also a problem with consistency and supply at that level. So I get contacted all the time by smallholders who are like, oh, do you have any advice? I've started an Instagram and we're a small family operation and we're running this type of herd and like I'm really passionate and like that's all great. But then their website is constantly sold out because they're only, killing just a few head a week. And purely from a commerce perspective, it's really hard to engage with people and get them to commit to your product. And get them interested if they're constantly just going to see us sold out. And I'm seeing that with a lot of these sort of direct to consumer programs. And it gets quite frustrating too, which is sort of an argument for getting together in a collective as well. But I think if you can focus on the pros that you think your product has, so talk about maybe, if you're on a certain type of feed, how you think that benefits the beef. Or whatever. I'm very beef centric, as you can tell. Obviously, there's more to the industry than just beef, but I think it's about keeping it positive, and not using phrases that suggest that other meat is somehow inferior. And I know that that's tricky, but if we even introduce the idea that some meat can be scary or dirty or unhealthy, ultimately, that could bite everyone in the butt one day. I think it's also that they're suggesting that the bigger the companies are, the less safe or the less healthy that beef is as well. And it kind of flies in the face of a lot of the work. I've been in, some very big processing plants in Australia, in Tees, Oakey, and you can eat off the floor. They're meticulously clean. And so it also becomes that thing of there's also some very, very smart, passionate people that work in the industry, even if it's for the MSA program, who dedicate their lives to bettering things at that bigger plant level, only to have smallholders or smaller companies try and suggest that somehow the beef that's coming through those plants is dirty or unclean. Like scientifically, we know that that's not the case at all. So I think it's really interesting.
It was very interesting. And I'm going to ask you for some social media pointers in a moment, actually.
Sure,
One
sure.
of the things you get all the time, obviously. But I just wanted to also just ask you, so what's your connection to ICMJ throughout your career? How have you sort of come in and out of contact with ICMJ?
So it was really interesting when I started to get more into meat. Once I sort of was traveling between Texas and Australia, or I was living in Australia, just kept traveling back to Texas because I enjoyed it. And I started to look for people in the industry to follow. And I started by following a couple of girls on Twitter who actually work for MLA, Demelza Lolback, who was an ICMJ judge or team leader rather, was one of the biggest influences in my meat life so far, because we just started chatting on Twitter and she was excited that someone who had, quite a few followers was interested in this journey. And she would say, like, oh, and here's this information, and oh, I've saved you this MLA pamphlet, or this might be interesting. And she helped facilitate a lot of the early education that I was able to get and access to the industry, because I really grew up in inner city Melbourne. I didn't have any ag background or any ag connection. And so through that, we forged a friendship and I've met other people. But eventually, by the time, flash forward a few years later, I was already living in Texas, and Demi was bringing one of the ICMJ groups on their annual tour, and I actually took them on a barbecue tour of Austin, because the really cool thing about Texas barbecue is the history of it lies in meat markets. So it's very closely connected with butchery. So we did sort of that tour because Austin was their first stop. And I've done that with two or three ICMJ groups. And then I was actually asked to come and speak at the conference in Wagga as well, from a social media standpoint, which has been super, super neat. So I've gotten to know a lot of different meat judging kids. Also, I speak at an event called Brisket Camp at Texas A&M University, and a lot of the students from there, I ended up going to Australia through ICMJ. I'm like, I know what that is, and I know that meat judging is not the eating of it, because that seems to be what most people default to. They don't really understand what it is. Everyone I've met in the meat industry, though it has a reputation of being very closed and, don't look behind this closed door and don't look behind the curtain, everyone I've met has been welcoming, wanting to share, wanting to tell their story, wanting to be open, wanting to learn. It's been extraordinary.
I mean, that's the hard bit, isn't it? When you're starting and you're, like you said, whether you've got a career and a background in agriculture or not, it can be really daunting to take those first steps out yourself and try and find connections. So when there's a group already set up of people who really genuinely want to help and want to teach you what they know, I mean, that's the hard work almost done for you.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing that really can't be overstated that we try and get taught in uni that doesn't make sense until way later in life is the idea of networking. And I've rarely had any success going to like a specific networking event where you're meant to show up and mingle and have a drink or two, because they're just so forced. But think about how many people you get to meet through the ICMJ program. I mean, and then because of that, I ended up going to the American Meat Science Association RMC conference. Then I ended up speaking at it. Then I ended up meeting, Diana Clark, who was on an ICMJ judge in her, I think, University of Illinois. And she's now the meat scientist for Certified Angus Beef. And now we have a relationship, a business relationship, and a friendship, and then met Dr. Carr, met a lot of the people here in Texas. And it's just like, imagine if you join that, like, you've already started to grow your corporate network without even realizing it, because everyone that you're at school with right now are your future colleagues.
You've got, as I mentioned, 134,000 Instagram followers. So you're, really successful in that space. But for people who are just starting out, it can just feel like, I mean, what's the point? There's already so many people on these platforms, on Instagram, for example, really successful people. When you sort of start to think, well, what can I add, or what would be the purpose of me chipping in there as well? It can sort of start to feel like maybe there's no point. But I know that you're quite passionate about people, giving it a go themselves and having their own platforms. So tell me why that is, and what would be your tips to someone who's just starting out with, zero followers but a lot of passion.
I think it's always good for passionate people to be out there sharing with other people. When it comes to social media, there's sort of nearly two different paths that we're talking about here. And one is just someone who wants to share their story, and another is someone who wants to grow from a more, I guess a more business perspective. Like, do you want to grow a brand? Do you want to be an influencer, or, whatever the buzzword is at the moment? And I think either way, there's no point in wanting to be an influencer and wanting to have a lot of fans if you don't have the passion and the content. So you don't just get to build it on the hollow ground. You don't just get to build this hollow shell of a profile, because people will see right through it. Really, you have to, there's a few things that you just have to do to play the game, and this is like straight social media tips. One is that you have to post frequently, very frequently. So you can't just log in once every couple of weeks and put something on there, because the algorithm will not be your friend. And people won't want to follow you if you're not going to provide them stuff on a regular basis. Two, the things that you might not find interesting are interesting to other people. So take a step back. So if you go out and feed cattle every day, you might want to tell them what you're feeding, why you're feeding. Is it bad? Like, for example, I went to a feedlot for the first time, and the guy said to me, "Look, we've got all these cattle laying down in the field. That means they're full and happy and they're in a herd." Well, again, I didn't grow up in ag, no idea what it means when cattle are sitting down or lying down, could be perceived as a bad thing. So all these things that you might already know could be interesting to someone else. So take a step back and make it educational, or just explain what you're doing. From a straight social media perspective, if a platform brings out a new thing it wants you to use, like Instagram recently released Reels, you want to use whatever it's telling you to use because it'll reward you for that. And you want to make sure your content looks good. So that doesn't mean you have to do a whole boyfriends of Instagram thing where you're posing on top of something ridiculous at the right time of the day just to get the shot. But it does mean that you should try and take nice photos, not blurry, not boring. So even if you have something interesting to say, if the photo that accompanies it is not engaging, no one is going to stop scrolling and stop and read what you have to say. And even then, people don't love to read. So it really has to come through in the content more than anything. And like, I've seen accounts for people from meat scientists that have so much to share, but the photos are just like either they're blurry or you can't really see what's going on, or just I just feel terrible because they're not, no one is stopping and reading this, and they should be, but that's the way the monster works.
And that can be quite intimidating, I think. Like, if you're someone who isn't a huge social media user yourself, you know, the idea that you're sort of putting yourself out there, your personal beliefs and, you know, out to the world, and you don't really know what could come back.
You don't, and that's a little bit intimidating. I would say this as well, though. Like, let's say you're trying to grow a brand, like you work for a company and trying to grow that company. If you're not a social media person, don't push it, because you're never gonna, you know, if you're too scared of it, or you're just like, oh, I just hate it and I don't want to do it, it's going to be an uphill battle the whole time. So if it's your brand, find someone that you can hand it off to who's happy to do that for you, because there will still come through, you know, people will be able to see that just in the frequency or the way you speak to people, or the way you're messaging. It's going to be obvious, and you don't want to sort of come out of the gates and, you know, be really gung-ho and then just give up on it either. It's sort of like it's like littering the social media space, you know? But I think that you don't need, yeah, I mean, I'm cautious with what I post. Like, I got married last year and I only, you know, I've been with my husband for several years, but I only just started posting him, like pictures of his face, this year, because I had to be comfortable about sharing. And it's so funny because we get on social media and we see people showing their kids and their lives and themselves in underwear, and it's no big deal. But you still probably need to think, like, you don't just share all of yourself. You have to think, like, should I say this? Like, you'll never hear me talk about politics online. I stay out of that completely. And so you do want to kind of curate your online persona to think, should I be saying this? Does it serve me well? That kind of thing.
And I think on the other side of the coin, there's people who are really passionate and interested in, you know, getting on social media, whether it's to just share their thoughts or to try and become an influencer. And you can see a little bit of success at the start and then perhaps a plateau. It's clearly not an overnight thing to get 100,000 followers. So what would your advice be, I suppose, to the people who feel like they're plugging away and posting as best they can, but they're sort of just not feeling any love in that space?
It is tough. And, you know, not everyone can have 100,000, 500,000 followers. You know, I can't promise you that do this and it'll be guaranteed, because, you know, I post about meat and recipes, and that's a really popular topic. Other examples of popular topics, like grilled cheese sandwiches, CrossFit. So there are just certain topics that are built for social media. If you run a dentistry account, you're probably going to have a really hard time. Although, you know, having said that, Dr. Pimple Popper and all sort of random things are also really successful. But I think that you should keep at it as best you can. The other big thing with social media is also cross engagement. So you're not just out there posting stuff and then logging off and saying, can't wait to come back and see who likes it. You have to engage with other people. You have to connect with them. You have to leave comments. You have to like other photos. You have to scroll and see what's out there. It does take a little bit of work, but just keep going at it. I think if you just try and be yourself, and then if that sparks something, give momentum to keep going. It's better than what you just described, which is, you know, 5 or 6 really overly posed shots out of the gate, pretending that you've already got like all this influence, and then no one responds, and then you just forget about the whole thing, if that makes sense.
And what about TikTok? Have you been tempted to give that a bit of a try as well?
Oh my God. So my best friend made me get on TikTok, and I yelled at him because I'm like, this is the worst. Yeah, I can't believe you made me do this. It's the worst. And I've sat there with my husband and felt like the oldest, crotchetiest person going, look at this. It's stupid. This person threw a slice of cheese at the car next to them and it's got 8 million views. Is this what we're teaching people? So I hated it for the longest time, but after Instagram introduced Reels, I just repost my Reels from Instagram on there, so I'm not putting in too much effort. And of course, like, it starts off and I feel like I'm talking to a black hole, even though I had all of these followings on the other platforms. And at one point I had a little bit of success with a video of a perfectly cooked medium rare steak, and there were just like comments for days, raw, that's not cooked. And I'm like, I hate this platform. I hate it. And then of course I posted a video last week that was like the most ridiculous. It was bacon wrapped pickles. Like, it was nearly a joke, and it's had 1.5 million views. So I guess that's proof that you just shouldn't give up.
It's a real unpredictable beast. Like you said, there's no recipe. There's no way to success. I suppose it's just, you know, deciding that you're going to work at it and committing to that for the long term.
The one thing that I don't like about TikTok, and again, this could be the dinosaur in me, because obviously the older I get, the more redundant I get with the new platforms. But the one thing that I don't like about it in terms of, is it worth your time? For all of the likes that I now have there, I haven't seen much conversion. So at the end of the day, what you want to do is either have people know who you are, have people buy your product. You know, it's got to lead to something. It's not just to feed because we crave likes or what have you. It's got to have purpose. And so far, the way that TikTok is built, like Instagram, you can, you know, you go to your bio, you read your bio, you kind of follow the links. TikTok is just much more about like quick, crunchy, disposable content.
This podcast is an initiative of the Australian Intercollegiate Meat Judging Association to showcase the career paths within the meat processing industry. ICMJ is a not-for-profit association which aims to provide opportunities for students to learn, building the pool of intelligent young meat industry representatives into the future. For more information, head to the website icmj.com.au.